So getting it, if you do want to get a copy of it, you can go and get it out via Git at that location shown at the bottom. And of course, you can go and grab BooFuzz as well, and you'll see that later. It's also included on your USB drive, but that's the one with the bug fixes. So setting it up, there's a couple ways we can do it. We could have the fuzzer and the target running on the same virtual machine or host, but more than likely we're going to want to fuzz between two machines because this really is a network protocol fuzzer, though you can use it to generate mutations for file format fuzzing as well, but you wouldn't be leveraging the socket functionality. So typically we've got a fuzzer running on one virtual machine, and then we've got targets on other machines across the network or virtual machines underneath the same host. And it uses a RPC channel that was written by Pedram Amini called PED-RPC, and it can communicate back and forth with the fuzzer itself and the controller, or the, I should say the target, which what's called procmon on the target. We'll get back to what procmon is soon. So we can hold off on kind of the inner working there. Just from this perspective, just know that you can fuzz locally or across the wire to multiple machines at the same time, including doing things like virtual machine control. So walking through that HTTP GET request, on the bottom there, you see a standard GET index.html, HTTP version 1.1, and then a host of sans.edu. And that's, we can look at the documentation. So again, time consuming because in order to fuzz well and get good code coverage, you'd want to read that RFC or as much as you need of it to be able to write things accordingly. And I'll show you some examples of what we're talking about here in a moment. So Sully functions start with the S underscore prefix, and it's basically to avoid namespace conflicts. That's all that really is. So you'll see a bunch of S underscore and then function names from in Sully. There's a global variable that gets referenced, and it's basically the name of the fuzzer, and you can call it whatever you want, and you'll later tie this together. You can tie multiple fuzzers together into a single session if you choose to do so. So here's an example of using the S underscore initialize function, and we're naming our fuzzer HTTP in this case. So that's like a global variable, and we can tie that into a session later on. Here we are setting an immutable value. So S underscore static, and that's the GET of the GET request. Now you certainly would want to try fuzzing the HTTP request type or verb itself, but once you've ruled out that there's any kind of buffer overflow or condition in that request type, you should probably leave it alone, right? You want to make sure you lead every request or every mutation with a valid HTTP request type, because otherwise, we talked about code coverage, you're not going to get through the front door of that process and you're not going to get any depth or code coverage. So once we roll that out, we set it to static, and that means every mutation that's generated, Sully will leave that as is and not try to fuzz it. Next up, we've got the space after the request type, which is a delimiter. That's how, you know, it reaches the end of the request type or string, and then it expects there to be a space there. So we can say S underscore delim for delimiter, specify what it's supposed to be, in this case a space, and then it will mutate through that field as it generates the mutations. Examples, repetition, substitution, exclusion, things like that. Then we put a static slash before the file name that we're trying to get. And we're setting that as S underscore string function to index.html. So Sully will now fuzz that using the mutation types on the left. So it'll try repeating it a bunch of times to look for a buffer overflow. It'll try omitting it to see if it causes any issue. Directory recursion on the front. Format strings to see if that causes a crash. It'll try command injection different ways to see if it can pop a calculator or similar. It'll try SQL injection. A carriage return line feed of times 1,000, null termination, binary strings, all these different things you see on the left. It's going to try and do that to see if it causes a problem. Now, some of those things it tries may not make any sense to what you're fuzzing, and you can certainly go and modify the libraries, but that's what it's going to try and do by default. And there's a finite number of things it's going to do, right? It's a mutation fuzzer. So when you use S underscore string, it's going to go through all those different techniques it knows how to do, And then it's done. It'll move on to the next field. So what about the GET request numbers? Now, in this example, we're talking about HTTP 1.1. How do we treat that? What data type is that? Is that a string? Is it a float? Is it a byte value, then a delimiter, then a byte value? I mean, you could probably think, well, it's probably just a string, but who knows? We don't know unless we have the source code or we reverse that to see what kind of data type the developer used for that particular field or whatever you want to call it. So this gives us the power to treat it as different data types here. We may want to treat it as a number, and we're saying S underscore byte or S underscore short, long, double, and we can specify the format. Is it an ASCII string or is it binary data? Is it little endian or big endian? Probably little endian if you're on x86 or x64. That's of course specifies what order the bytes are sent across. Sully tests the negative and positive 10 border cases near zero and maximum values. It does common divisors. Again, all in an effort to cause a crash. So here's how we ended up doing it in our example. You can see towards the bottom right, S underscore byte 1 format equals string. So that's the 1 in 1.1. And then we use S underscore delim. So we're treating that dot as a delimiter. And then we do another S byte 1 and format as string. Now you may ask, well, is that the right answer? We don't know, right? That's why we're fuzzing. If it doesn't do anything, we can go back and we can change the data type or treat it all as one big string or a float even. We don't have to say it's a delim in the middle. That's the trial and error part. And then we finish up. You know, a lot of these screenshots are truncated or snippets because we don't have enough space to fit everything on the screen. So we're focusing on the bottom of the slide here on the right, where we're just adding in the host information of sans.edu with a double carriage return and line feed. So some additional things. Based on the fact that we used S underscore string and delim and byte a number of times, remember I said that each time we use that function, there's a finite number of mutations it's going to do. So I'm making this up, but let's say that each time you use S underscore string, that's 100 mutations it's going to go through in that field. And each time you use delim, that's 10 mutations it's going to go through in that field. So it's going to count the number of times you use those different functions and the number of mutations associated with each of those functions. And if you want to know how many mutations total, you can use SNum mutations to get that information. The other thing we're doing on this snippet is just a little loop that counts down to zero, and it gives you a chance to control C your way out in case you want to cancel once you start. Definitely not necessary. Here is the sleep time at the top. That is, you don't want to send the request too quickly to the target because it might not be able to keep up with the rate. So if we set a sleep time to 0.1, that's going to be 1/10 of a second. So every 10th of a second, it's going to send another mutation across the wire. And as long as the target server can keep up with that, then great. We also see at the bottom there, it's trying to estimate how long the fuzzing session will take by doing a little basic math, counting the number of mutations and the amount of time it has to wait in between sending each one of those mutations. Here, if you're the type of person who likes to see what is being sent across, like what the mutation looks like, you can use srender and smutate functions, and you can have the mutations printed on the screen, as well as hex dump or other. So there's different ways you can look at what's happening and visualize that. And here's a screenshot of what it looks like. We start up our fuzzer, it does a little countdown, it shows us the number of mutations, and then we can see what's being sent across as it happens. Now, the very first examples of what's being sent across over on the right looks like the GET request that we wrote into the fuzzer, and that's correct. The very first thing Sully will send out is what you wrote in it before it starts actually mutating. You also see a different request type like POST instead of GET. That's because the code was probably modified to go in and set up something like a little list of request types, maybe HEAD, TRACE, POST, GET, and then each mutation, it can iterate through that request type trying the same mutation with each of those verbs. And then you see omitted for space, and at the bottom, at some point, you see a directory traversal or request going through. And when I demo, we'll look at a couple examples. So Sully sessions, this allows us to identify the fuzzer name, the global variable that we created with the S underscore initialize function. And this is where we can tie in multiple fuzzers together if we want. And it's got control options. We can send over TCP, UDP, or SSL, HTTPS. It uses graph theory to fuzz. And it doesn't fuzz multiple things at the same time, at least not natively. You have to go in and modify the code to do that. So it'll go and fuzz different fields at different times. So we want to create a session. So you can see at the top, we've changed our sleep time to 0.5 in this case, so half a second. And then in the bottom, we have a variable called mySess. So we've got my session variable equals session.session, and we're setting the options in there. Session file name, that we can name that whatever we want. That's just going to keep track of what mutations have been sent so far. And if we ever want to start over, we might want to go and delete that file. So we're calling it http.sess in this case. Our sleep time is set to that 0.5 or half a second. That's how long it's going to wait before it sends the next mutation. Then we've got a timeout equals 10. That means if it sends a mutation and it doesn't hear back from the target like it should, and 10 seconds goes by, it's going to assume that the target has crashed. And there's this crash threshold variable here. We set it to 3 in this example, and that means if the target crashes 3 times, terminate the fuzzing session. What happens a lot is when you're fuzzing, you hit duplicate crashes. Maybe it sends A times 100, it causes a crash. And then it says 200, cause a crash, 300. And so it keeps hitting the same bug over and over again. And that's why you might want to set the crash threshold. So here we're simply saying a new line of code, mysess.connect. So we're using the connect option, and we're getting the HTTP global variable, and we're just adding the fuzzer to the session in that case. And now we're specifying the targets. So you can see where it says target equals sessions.target. We're setting it to 10.10.10.10 port 80. That's the target IP and port number of the service we want to fuzz. And then we've got target.netmon and then procmon. We'll talk about those in a moment. But notice that they're both on the same IP address on different ports. This would be an instance where we're fuzzing on the local system. When I show a demo a little bit later, what I want to show you is two different systems. I want to fuzz from one VM to another VM so we can see how that works with tools like Netmon. From a high level, and we'll go into more detail soon, Netmon creates a PCAP file for every mutation that goes across. So we do syn, senac, acc, and we send a mutation. It creates a PCAP of that whole session. So every mutation number is going to have a PCAP file with the number of the mutation as its file name. Then procmon, it does a couple of things. This is one of the nice things it does on Windows that it doesn't do on Linux. If that crash threshold is met, if the timeout, I mean, is met, where 10 seconds goes by or whatever you send it to, and we don't hear back from the target, we can issue the commands across RPC telling it to stop the target service, start it back up again, and then continue from where it left off based on that session file. So in this example, we're doing the final piece. We're just adding the target, and then we're fuzzing. That would be the last couple lines of code that runs, and that's going to kick off your fuzzer. So Sully agents, we talked about a couple of these already, netmon, procmon, and VM control. VM control, as I mentioned earlier, it can start VMs, it can stop them, it can reset them, it can take, delete, and restore snapshots, which is really neat that it can do that. So you could say something like, if you're fuzzing and a crash occurs, then record that, but then revert back to a known good state. Just an example of something you can do. You do have to play around with that a bit. It may require editing the code or even using specific versions of VMware or VMware server, but it's a cool option, cool feature. Netmon and procmon specifically, let's talk about those. As I mentioned, it's not a requirement. You don't have to run it. It works on Windows or Linux, but what it does is it creates a PCAP file for every mutation that goes across with the mutation number as the file name, and it's serialized, so it'll be mutation 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way up until it exhausts however many were sent. It requires an admin or root because you're running a fuzzer. To be able to sniff, you've got to have that level of access. Procmon is extremely useful. This does two things. One, like I mentioned, it will stop and start the service and communicate over RPC. You'll see this soon. And the other thing it does is it uses PyDebug from the PyMay project, also from Pedram Amini, and that it gets the debugging context when a crash occurs. So procmon will basically debug the target process that's being fuzzed, and when a crash occurs, it grabs the state, like the stack information and the disassembly and registers, other data, and it will record that for you into a file that you specify. So running Sully, when you run it, it starts up a web server on port 26,000, as you can see on the right. That's only running as long as the fuzzer's running. When you kill the fuzzer, that goes away, and you'll have to do post-mortem analysis. But while the fuzzer's running, if you get, look at the bottom where those orange colors are the number of test cases, and it's got a description next to it, those are clickable links. Those are mutation numbers. And you can click on one. You can go view what procmon grabbed from debugging the target when it crashed. When it's done, though, you've got to use the postmortem tools. And I'll demo both of these postmortem tools in a moment. PCAP Cleaner and Crash Bin Explorer. So Crash Bin is typically the file that you would create that PyDebug would dump out the context of the process during the crash. And so PCAP Cleaner, what it does is removes any PCAP files that are unrelated to one of the crashes. And it does this by looking at the Crash Bin file that you create with procmon, and it grabs the mutation numbers and deletes any of the ones that didn't cause a crash. Crash Bin Explorer basically lets you look at the Crash Bin file and dump out the debugging context when a crash occurred. And there's just a screenshot of it, but I'll show you this in a moment so we don't have to worry about that. So killing it, just because Python doesn't like to respond to Control C, Control D, at times you might want to use Task Kill or WMI, or you can just go into Task Manager and kill it that way if you want to get your command shell back. You can also record some date and time information into a log file if you want. So BooFuzz, Sully's feature successor, I mean, it is a successor, but we've run into some issues. Let's talk about it. It's a fork of Sully, but Joshua took it over, and that's fantastic that he did that. It's wonderful when someone creates such a great tool, and then they let it go, and then we have people who come in and want to continue that project, similar to what happened with PowerShell Empire not so long ago. So BooFuzz works similarly to Sully, but it doesn't provide backwards compatibility, so you would have to go in and modify your script to match the syntax expectations for BooFuzz. Also uses different prototypes. So it supports raw layer 2 and layer 3 packet crafting, which is really nice, and serial port fuzzing, so there are some improvements there. On the left, you see the original script, and then on the right, you see changes that had to be made to match the syntax expected by BooFuzz. And this isn't really a lesson on how to port over to BooFuzz, but you would just have to read through the documentation and make sure you match all that up. So here's one of the problems that occur with us. When we ran the fuzzer, and crashes were happening with Sully, BooFuzz wasn't getting those same crashes, and we weren't getting the same results across the wire, and we weren't able to see them the same way we were with Sully. And I'm not sure quite why. This may be something that's already fixed recently or is going to be fixed, but because of a couple limitations like this, that's why we haven't switched over to using BooFuzz instead of Sully, but I'm sure we'll do that at some point. So in summary, that's a quick intro to Sully, and it shows you how it's a powerful framework to do some basic fuzzing. And, you know, we could have chosen Peach or Spike or any fuzzer. We just chose this one because it's Python-based, not XML and such, and kind of goes with the flow of this book's material. And it really is a nice, easy framework to use, and we've got a lab for you to do in the extended hours. Now, that lab I'm going to show you right now. Feel free to pause this and skip this and go to the next module if you don't want to see this walkthrough, and if you want to do it yourself first in the extended hours. But just because we talked about Sully, I think it's a good spot to go ahead and do this. So I've got two virtual machines. They're both Windows 7 because that's what I happen to have them set up on. You're going to use Windows 10 in your example. The reason I'm going to do this on this Windows 7 system is because I've got it already set up and ready to go to where one's going to be the fuzzer and the other one's going to be a target. And I'm going to show you how we can use Netmon to capture the PCAP files and just kind of the whole thing that you would go through. I could easily do the same thing by cloning the Windows 10 VM as well, but for sake of time, I've got this already ready to go here. So this system is where we're going to run procmon, and this is the target. This is the system that's going to be fuzzed. So I'm going to go ahead and start up Savant, which is the web server that we're going to fuzz. So there it is. And then here is the command, process monitor minus C. So where is our crash bin file going to be stored? We're putting it in the audits folder, and we're going to call it savant.crashbin. That's where the PyDebug results are going to get written. Then minus P, process, savant.exe. So we run this, and it's just waiting for the fuzzer to start. It's waiting for requests. Then we go over to the fuzzer system, and I've got this network monitor command ready to go. We've got a filter for port 80. We are writing the PCAP file to the audits folder. Now, currently, if we go over here to dev Sully audits, there's nothing in there right now. I'm going to go ahead and start this up, and it's waiting for us to start the fuzzer. So we've started procmon. We've started netmon. Now let's go ahead and start up the fuzzer. If you look inside the http.py file, I simply change the netmon server and the procmon server to the right IP addresses so this all works. So we start this up and say go, and then you can see 3, 2, 1, and it's going to send its first mutation across. So fuzzing 1 of 1,074, and there are the PCAP files showing up, and it's doing its thing. So we bring up Internet Explorer in this case, and I go to my local host on port 26,000, and you can see it's going through the fuzzing, the mutations. No crashes have occurred yet. It doesn't automatically refresh. I'm hitting refresh. So we'll go over to the target and take a look, and you can see it's just having everything come across. We're waiting to see if a crash occurs. It should happen pretty soon because the fuzzer I wrote definitely triggers a bug, and it just crashed. You can see it says cause an access violation, moving into ECX dereference EAX, and then it starts it back up, waits 5 seconds, tells the fuzzer that to continue where it left off based on a session file, and another one came across, and it crashed it again. And here you can see it caught those crashes. I'm going to keep refreshing. And now look, it all of a sudden says it's completed. That's because I set my crash threshold to 3. Now the fuzzer's still open. I haven't killed it, so I can click on these links, and it shows you the context. There's the register state, the line of code where the crash occurred, the disassembly around it, and some SEH information. And we can see just by looking here, we are moving into ECX, dereference EAX, but EAX holds 4141 4141. So that's why the crash occurred. I'll close the browser, and I'm going to stop the fuzzer. So I'm just going to bring up Task Manager, and we'll end the Python process. And we'll go over to the target, and we'll do the same thing. So bring up Task Manager and kill the Python process. So we're on the target system that got fuzzed. If we go into audits, you can see there's this crash bin file that's been created, and we can move this over to the target here in a moment. So let's move that over. I'm going to go into audits and dev sully audits, and we'll grab savant.crashbin. I'm going to paste it to a shared folder I have or had. I need to enable it real quickly, just so I can get it over to the other system. All right, so that should work now. So we'll paste that in. Now it's in my shared folder. We go over to the fuzzer system, and I'm going to kill Task Manager. We're going to go over to the shared folder and grab the crash bin file and put that into our dev sully folder. Now let's paste it in. Before we do anything more, let's look at the audits folder. There are all those PCAP files, and let's take a look at a couple. So double click on a random one, 9, and we go in Wireshark, and we can see exactly what it's doing here. So it sent a head in, index.html, and then /?/? And it's just trying different delimiters in that case. Let's look at another random one, like 14. In this one, you can see it's sending a bunch of binary data, it looks like. It's weird stuff there. Let's take another one. How about 17? This one, you can see %00, so it just sent one odd byte there. Take a look at one more. And in this one, continuation or non-HTTP traffic, doesn't look like it sent anything interesting in that case. It's probably just a basic one. So let's try 30 then. So here you see it says some SQL syntax. So you can see exactly what it's doing. Now let's use PCAP cleanup tool so we can get rid of all those PCAP files that didn't cause a problem. So to do that, take a quick look at this directory in Sully. We're going to go into, we'll go into our, where that script is located. So utils, it should be in utils. So we'll say utils and then pcapcleaner.py. If you run it by itself, it wants the name of the crash bin file and then the path to the PCAPs. So savant.crashbin and then audits. Now when I run this, watch the left, you can see the PCAP files will disappear. And we're left with only the ones that caused the crash. So we bring up one of those, and you can see exactly what was sent in to cause the crash. So finally, let's use the other postmortem tool, Crash Bin Explorer. So we'll say utils, Crash Bin Explorer, and it wants the name of the crash bin file. So we'll just give it to it. And it shows us mutations 43, 44, and 45 caused the crash, and that's where the PCAP cleaner got its info. and I'm going to say minus T and give it one of those mutations. And there you can see it dumps out the same information that we were able to see while it was actively being fuzzed. So the crash information. So that's the end of the demo or walkthrough. What you're going to want to do in the extended hours is we give you a starting script and we want you to go and try to write the syntax that triggers this bug that I just showed you. And it's going to take trial and error if you don't just read the answer. So it's good experience. You know there's a bug there. You're not wasting your time and you can go and try and find it yourself. And in general, that's if you want to get more practice with fuzzing and experience, go to ExploitDB. A lot of times there's a vulnerable application next to the exploit. Don't look at the exploit, but download the vulnerable application, start fuzzing it, and see if you can get it to crash. And if you can, you'll try to weaponize it. And if you can't find the bug, look at the answer and the exploit and learn from that. And then there's hundreds of more that you can go in and practice on. It's a really great way to keep up. Next up, we're going to talk about fuzzing block coverage measurement. So we'll do both block coverage and source code assisted fuzzing because they're both equally important. Sometimes you're going to have the source code available and sometimes you will not have the source code. So we want to understand how we can measure our code coverage regardless of whether or not we do have or don't have the source code. So our objectives with this first one, this is block coverage. We are going to look at the concepts around how we go about measuring code coverage. We'll look at how to improve the quality of our fuzzer and then how we again measure that basic block coverage in our binaries. So this one's going to quickly, it's only a couple slides we're going to talk about, and then I'm going to jump over to a demonstration or walkthrough of the lab that you're going to be performing. So obviously covering more code means you're likely to find more bugs. We'll use the bad example of like low hanging fruit, right? If you've ever walked by like an apple tree or something out in the wild, the lower fruit is always all gone and you have to go way high up in the tree to find it. So it takes more work. You've got to get deeper into the code to find the good stuff. Everybody's fuzzed the easy areas to reach in an application, but to get deeper is what we need to do to find the more obscure bugs or just ones that are harder to reach. So we want to measure coverage under normal operation, and we'll walk through that, and then repeat it under the fuzzer. And then maybe we can go in, inspect the code that we've reached, look for things like maybe there's some banned functions or some, again, known bad functions that shouldn't be used, like strcpy and gets and sprintf and others, and we can try and tweak or modify our fuzzer to reach that code that we're interested in. So basic blocks, if we look at an example here on the slide, it's showing a couple blocks, but let me actually just bring up IDA real quickly because I think it's going to be a little more practical to look at. So I'll just run and let me revert back to a different snapshot as well while I'm at it so I know this will work. I'm just going to bring up the Sophos antivirus engine again because we had that up before, and we'll just recap on what a block of code is inside of a function and read a couple lines of assembly. As soon as this comes up. All right, so IDA, I'll say go, and we'll go ahead and bring up Sophos antivirus. Okay, so it's loading in now, and where this has some random function, let me click on a different one. So now we're inside a function. What you're looking at, and it's just a random function. We don't have symbols, so I don't have the names of the functions. This is subroutine 419F62. And if we zoom out, you can see that's the whole function. And those are all blocks within this function. And we can zoom back in. And the blocks, how do we know it's the end of a block? It's usually some kind of an edge indicator. Like in this case, it does a comparison to what's in EDI and what's in EBX. And depending on the result of that comparison, if it's true, it says jump if not zero. Well, if it's true, then we won't take the jump. If it's not true and the comparison doesn't match, then we're going to take the jump because we did not equal zero. And you can see it tells you if you're jumping because it didn't equal zero, you're going to go to 419F8B, which is down. So we skip that block directly below it. So those are edges. Some of them have conditions like jump on zero, jump if below or equal. Sometimes there's just a return there like you see. Other time there's a mandatory jump. So that's kind of what an edge is, and that's what we mean by block measurement. I want to know, if I come to this block, did I then go, well, in this case, we had to go to that one, but let's use the block below it. If I go to this block, there's a comparison of something on the stack to what's stored in the EBX register. So if that's true, we won't take the jump. If it isn't true, we'll take the jump, and that's going to determine which path we go. So I want to be able to measure block coverage. Wouldn't it be cool if we could color code the path that we took through a process based on our input? And then we can go and inspect it and say, well, why didn't we go this other way? I feel like if I would have gone the other way, maybe I could have triggered some kind of a bug. And that's the whole idea. So let's close that. Dynamo Rio, we used to use a tool called PyMay in the class, but it just kind of got a bit deprecated. So we use Dynamo Rio, which is a very popular runtime code manipulation framework. And we can do lots of neat stuff with blocks. So it's good for a bunch of different processors that you see listed there. And it's great for gaining insight to applications where we don't have the source code. So let's go ahead and take a look at it. Now, instead of walking through the slides here, I'm going to go over to a demo, a walkthrough, and explain what each of these commands are doing and how it's all working. So let's jump over to the Windows 10 system. All right. And I'll bring up a couple command prompts. And I'm already in the right directories, as you can see. So I've got one command prompt in my dev folder and one command prompt in my dev Dynamo Rio 7 bin 32 folder. And the first thing we're going to do is run a tool called drrun. And drrun, it's going to allow us to start up a process and then create a log. And then from that log, we can create what's called an IDC file, which is an IDA scripting file. And then we can import the results from when we fuzz it or when we just manually go through it with a browser, that being the target web server. And then that should be able to color code inside IDA so we can see which path we took or didn't take. And that's kind of the goal here. So if we just run from inside our bin 32 folder, drrun.exe, you can see the commands here. And of course, you can read through each one. We're going to end up using the minus T option, which is for tool. And we're going to say the tool we want to use is drcov. So what happens if we just say minus T drcov, like that? It comes back and just gives us the regular uses. It says no app specified. Okay, well, we must need to specify an app. So we say drcov, we'll say minus dump text, because we wanted to create the log file, and then minus C colon backslash savant.exe. That's what we want to start up. So let's see if this works. And it did. We started up Savant, and it's going to log everything that happens. And now what we want to do is bring up a browser, and we're going to go to 127.0.0.1 index.html. And you can see it. We got some logs in the Savant server and we see the default page. I'm going to refresh, hit F5 a couple times, and then I'm going to click on a link. It's probably going to give us an error message. We'll go back. And that's all we really need to do. We're just trying to mimic normal usage. So we close that. I close the browser. Then I'm going to go over and click on Savant shutdown. Yes, I would like to shut down. And notice on my screen for drrun, it automatically stopped. If you go and do what I just showed you and it doesn't stop and still hangs, that means something's wrong. It's not going to successfully generate the log file. Go ahead, if that happens, and hit Control C, bring up Task Manager and make sure the Savant process is dead, and then try it again and make sure your command line syntax is correct. So next up, we're going to do the same thing again. So I restart Savant using the same command, but this time we're going to run a fuzzer that we put onto your dev folder. So we'll say httpfuzz.py, and we're going to let this run for a minute. And you can see in the Savant window, it's sending in a bunch of random data. So it's just a little randomized fuzzer. You can free, of course, to take a look at what exactly it's doing. I'm hoping I can let this run long enough. I don't want to waste too much time, that what the fuzzer does ends up being or taking different paths, at least some, than what the normal usage through the browser did. That's kind of the goal here. So we can see the color-coded results. So I think that hopefully it's long enough. Let's control C. And then I'm going to go to Savant, shut down. And there you can see Dr. Run, whatever you want to call it, DR Run, stopped. So now we should have two log files in here. If I say dir star.log, you can see there's two log files that were created, 1 minute apart, which is important to remember because we have to name these things accordingly. The first one we did with the earlier timestamp was the one in the browser. The second one was the fuzzer. So I'm going to say move star.log to my /dev folder, just so I know where it is, and we did. And then over in the dev folder, we're going to run a tool called DynaPStalker that was written by Josh Wright to mimic what PyMay does. So let's go ahead and run DynaPStalker, DynaPStalker.py, and then the log file. So dr, and I hit tab complete. Now don't assume that the log file numbers mean that that one was generated first since it's a lower number. Always look at the timestamp so that you know you're using the right one. So if I look back here, the timestamp of the one that I want to use first is 6:50 p.m. in this example. So let's verify that file, the timestamp, 6:50, the file is 5844. So 5844, that was the first one I ran. So I've got the correct log file, and then I'm going to say the name of the executable, savant.exe, and then savant-base, I'm calling it, .idc, that's the scripting language for IDA, the native one, and then we're going to specify the code. So I'll put 00FFFF, I believe that's green, and the other one we're going to use is yellow, and we hit enter, and it created an IDC file. We're going to do the same thing again, but this time we're going to use the other file, so 03020. And then we'll say savant.exe, and then I'll call this one savant-fuzzed.idc, and the color this time I'll do 0x00FF00, so a slightly different color. I think one's yellow, one's green. You could play around with that option if you want. So now we've got the two IDC files. I'm going to go ahead and bring up IDA demo. So we bring that up. Evaluation. So when I brought this up before, it said expired, and that's why I set my date back. So we'll just say go, and we'll click on file open. Go to your Savant folder in the C drive and double-click savant.exe. It comes up and says it's identified it as a portable executable file for Windows. Say OK. No, we don't have debugging symbols, so say no. And what it's doing is it's disassembling it now. And it should only take a moment because it's not a very large program. And it's done. So feel free to click around on the different functions up in the map at the top and hit the space bar to go back and forth between disassembly mode and graphical mode. You can see here this is a pretty large function. And you can practice reversing if you want. But the lab's going to have you go and hit G so we can jump to an address. And you're going to enter in 406430 and hit enter. That's going to take us to this function here. And why this function's interesting is if we zoom in, look at what it's doing. String comparison against the string connection, accept language, referrer, if modified since. So these are all HTTP things that it's checking for. And depending on whether or not they exist inside the HTML, it will take one path versus another path. So if I see this if modified since here and double click on it, it takes us down to the next line of code that it goes to, leading to an strn copy call. So first thing we're going to do is load in the IDC script that we generated by going to file, script file. We'll go to /dev, and we've got these two IDC scripts. And we're going to click on base. That's the one that we did with the browser. And we click open, and see how it color codes it yellow? So great, we see some yellow blocks were hit here. If we go up to the top, we can see all the yellow blocks hit and then a bunch of blocks weren't hit. So what I'm hoping to see now when I open up the IDC file from our fuzzer, that we reach some different areas of code. So again, we'll say file, script file, and we'll click on Savant Fuzzed and say open. And there you can see we hit some additional blocks of code. And that's the purpose. That's the purpose of this demo and this tool, and to show you that we can go in and modify, change the color, and test whether or not we reach these new blocks of code. And if we see something like a vulnerable stir copy call, maybe we want to know, well, why didn't we hit it? The example I was showing before, with that band function script I wrote. So let's try and run that real quick. So we say script file, and we'll go out to the network. Actually, I don't have band functions on here. Let me see if I can copy it in real quickly, just because I'm curious to see what kind of result we get. Not sure if we'll get a good result, but we can try. So band functions, I'll just copy this in. And this thing's available online for free on GitHub. I wrote it years ago. I need to update it for Python 3 with IDA 7.4, but whatever. Now let's go and run that script file. It's in our dev folder, band functions. And it comes back and says function declaration is expected. What is the problem here? Well, I don't have time to troubleshoot this now, unfortunately. I'm not sure why it's not working. It's probably something to do with this particular version of the IDA demo. But either way, what I was going to try and do, I can show you the manual way, which is if we go to the imports table here and we go and look for, is there any calls to like stir copy or stir cat or something dangerous besides just strn copy? So I'm just looking through here. Give me a moment. I see create file A. I see all this strn copy calls, but I don't see strn copy actually in the imports table here unless I missed it. Let's go back and see the main screen and go down to this, it's underscore strn copy, but still, did I just completely miss the underscores? Well, let's do a cross-reference. So we'll go back to there and we'll just double click on strn copy. And that takes this, oh, it looks like it was statically compiled in. Let's see what functions are called by this guy. So view, subviews, function calls, and we'll see if this, nope, this doesn't call anything. A bunch of people call stir and copy, but they put it into the program itself. That's really odd. And this is in the Sophos antivirus. I don't know why they would do that. I know there's some calls to stir cat too, or stir copy. I wonder if we can find those. So there's strn cat, there's stir cat, there's stir copy. So double click on that. And that says jump short copy start. Yeah, I don't know what this thing's doing. So anyway, what I was going to try and quickly do is say, well, if we can find that there's a stir copy call, then we can check to see if we hit that block of code or not. And it shows us, we saw that this program's kind of weird. So anyway, let's go ahead and stop the demo here. You get the point. Really powerful tool. And as you saw, it just happened to me. You start to get jumped down a rabbit hole. You're like, well, this could be cool here. Let me go and try this. And like, it should excite you a bit and trying to see if there's vulnerabilities, because you can absolutely find vulnerabilities doing this kind of combo of dynamic and static analysis. So I'm going to jump back out to the slide deck here. And it just goes you through the exercise. That's what I just demoed. So feel free, of course, if you didn't already, to pause and take some time to do that now. And you can go back and walk through the demo I just showed you as well. And then when you get to the end, you're right about there. So the point of that, again, was to show you how to do code coverage when you don't have the source code. And we'll continue on with source-assisted fuzzing with the American Fuzzy Lop. This is a tool that was written by Elkam Tuf, or I think it's Mikhail Zalewski, who left Google a while ago, and I believe he works at Snapchat. He might be somewhere else now, but I believe Snapchat. Either way, he wrote this tool AFL, which is a fantastic tool that's seen a ton of growth and community support, and it's impossible to even keep up with all the forks that have been created. So this is just an intro to how AFL works, and you'll get a chance on your Linux system, your Kali box, to run AFL against the target and get some positive results from it. So first off, what is code execution marking? We know that fuzzers find more bugs when they get greater code coverage. Makes sense. So far it's been like a manual process, and we did that block coverage analysis and we wrote the fuzzer ourselves. Well, what if we had this amazing fuzzer that was able to create the test cases and mutations for us, as well as do the monitoring and everything needed all in one? That would be AFL. So what is this execution marking thing? For each line of code in the source, so we have the source code and we use a special compiler or wrapper to compile the source code. And when it gets compiled, a tuple is created for each line of code. And it's a unique ID for that specific location, and then the ID of the previously executed location. So it can be used for tracking. We can see where we went through the executable lines of code, and we can see where we didn't get to. So requirements to do that, we need the source code to mark and monitor. We need a customized compiler or wrapper that can do the instrumentation and the marking. We need a tool to monitor the instrumentation and, again, generate the test cases, identifying new code paths reached, and just do this all dynamically. And that brings us, of course, to the American Fuzzy Lab from Mikhail Zelusky. So it is a bunch of things. It's a bunch of binaries. But one of the things it does, it's a wrapper for GNU C compiler. And it builds a source and adds in that tuple marker and that instrumentation that we already talked about. It was written originally to test binary input files, not network protocol fuzzing, but to generate files that are opened by applications to, and then to debug them and generate test cases. And again, it's got that automated mutation test case generation. And you can give it a sample input that it bases its mutations off of, or you can do multiple. We'll get there in a moment. So test case generation, how does it go about mutating? It does different things. It just chooses fields. So the example that I'm going to walk you through is the one that you'll do after this in an exercise in the extended hours of bootcamp. And you're going to give it a PCAP file. And it's a PCAP file with a very specific packet capture type in it. And it's going to go through and just start doing things like flipping bits within a byte or flipping a whole byte or doing arithmetic changes like negative, positive. It's going to do known integer changes like try negative one and different divisors. It's going to do randomized test cases, but there are finite randomized test cases, if that makes any sense. So it's going to try doing things like take previous tests and then append random data on it, and then do things like take two previous mutations, split them both in half, and then put them together. So it does weird things like that, but there's a threshold associated with it. So it only tries a certain number per each one, and that's why it's finite. So it randomly does things, but it is finite before it continues on to doing other things. And you would look at this and think, well, why would that cause so many problems and be so effective? But it is, and there's a lot of documentation and theory that goes into why. And it also does things like when it does a walking bit flip, it will flip a bit, and then it'll try two bits, then three bits, then four bits, then five bits, and then maybe it stops because Mikhail Zelusky came back and said, you know, there was minimal return on investment when you start going beyond that and flipping even more bits versus just flipping a byte of bits, or if that makes sense, flipping all the bits within a byte at once. So the effectiveness, this is a screenshot that's been updated since this was taken, but this just shows you an example of some of the binaries that have been or fallen victim to AFL. And those are some serious names, right? Internet Explorer, Firefox, Chrome, OpenSSH, TCP dump. We've heard of these applications before. And those links there are linked to CVEs, the vulnerabilities that were discovered and have been patched. It really is almost unfair when you run AFL against a binary. And I certainly, it's fun to do bug hunting with, but don't go and download some open source project, compile it with AFL, and then fuzz it, find some bugs, and then just submit a bug report to the author. If it's an open source project and you're just doing that, you're not really helping the cause. Now, because there's bugs in every application. If you take the time, though, and you determine that one of those or two of those are actually vulnerabilities and that you can exploit them and you send that to the author, that absolutely is a good use of that person's time. It's just that you will find bugs with this thing very easily, and you want to make sure that you're sending useful information to a potential developer or author. So using AFL, here you can see in the top example, very basic. We're compiling with AFL GCC. The output file is packets, and then packets.c is the source code here. And then when we go down, you can see we're doing autoconf or the CMake autosystem. Like, there's different ways we can compile code, of course, some more complex than others. And it just shows you the ways that you would go about compiling it. And then you need to create an input and an output file where the mutations will be stored or written to, or the results will be written. And then you start AFL like it shows you on the bottom. And I'm quickly going through this because I'm about to demo it here in a moment. So there's a walkthrough in this slide that just shows you fuzzing TCPIC, which you used in the crypto section. And it's just going to have you do the compilation of it with AFL so it does the instrumentation. You're going to then run AFL, and you're going to get a crash with it. So feel free to read the notes there, but instead we're going to do the walkthrough here. First though, there is some really good graphical information that you can get to kind of show you over a period of time how many bugs were found or how many crashes were detected, how many mutations were generated, just performance data that you can get. When you go and look at the, after you do a fuzzing session, you can look at the crashes folder if there were any crashes, which there probably will be, and you can see the names of them. And you can see in the name, it says flip one, and the bottom one says flip four. So it tells you a little bit about what type of mutation caused the crash. And then there on the bottom, you can see we're running tcpic minus r, and we're reading in one of those mutations that caused the crash, and it does in fact cause the seg fault to occur. And you see it, like it says on a slide, packet length is reportedly negative 32 bytes. And I bet you it's a memcopy culprit here. It then, as you go in, well, not an example, but there's an option you can use called AFL tmin. This is to minimize the test cases. One of the problems this is trying to solve is trying to think of a good example. I mean, imagine if you have you've crafted up a mutation, and that mutation caused the target binary to crash. Does everything that you put into that mutation, is everything in that mutation necessary to cause the crash? Or is there a bunch of stuff that's completely unrelated that if you were to go in and remove it, you could minimize the test case and get it down to a smaller example that still causes the crash to occur? And the point being that there might be a bunch of stuff in there that's distracting you that has nothing to do with the crash condition. So what it can do is it'll keep trying to trim down the test case or the mutation that caused the crash to occur. And if it still causes the crash, then great, it trimmed it down some. It'll try to trim it more and more and more. And if it tries to trim it and it doesn't cause the crash anymore, it knows to put that back in again because it didn't cause the crash. So you're trying to minimize the amount of data from distracting you in that mutation, yet still cause the crash. In this case, you can see the tcpic crash analysis. We recompile the tcpic binary and such with debugging symbols. We want to have the debugging symbols, and we want to remove the optimization. And that's what you see up there in the cflags equals ggdb whole thing. And then we go and in GDB run the mutation that causes the crash to occur. And you can see it shows you the line of code. And it says memcopy underscore SSSE3. And we see fragments.c line 111. And we can go in when we look at that backtrace and see exactly what line of code or where the crash occurred and what line of code it was. Some recommendations. You want to use minimal examples of test cases. You wouldn't say, I want to fuzz a PDF reader, I'm going to give it a 10 meg PDF document. That doesn't make sense. You want to give it something useful, like a valid PDF document, but not something that's going to be overly large. It's going to cause it to slow down and generate so many more test cases and probably with data that doesn't really even matter. So give it something useful, but small. Also, you might want to use a RAM disk instead of something like SSD because SSDs only have a certain number of I/O that it can handle before it burns out. So it'll burn them out pretty quickly. So a RAM disk is probably better. And of course you can start and stop AFL as needed and you can have it resume as well. So in summary, like I mentioned at the beginning, just a quick intro to what AFL does. We're not trying to write an AFL class, although that would be really cool, but there's a ton of documentation online on AFL and you can kind of continue your research there. Look at all the forks and features that people have created and see which one works best for you. Now, let me go ahead and do the walkthrough of AFL right now that you'll be doing in the bootcamp or extended hours. So I'm going to go over to a Kali Linux system where I've got everything ready to go. So I'm in my bootcamp day 3 IPDECAP folder. So IP decapsulation is the tool that we're going to be going after. And if I take a step back here and do a ls, there's a file called 6in4pcapng. That is going to serve as your source file, your mutation file, your sample file that it's going to generate mutations from. So it's just it's called 6in4 because it's an IPv6 encapsulation capture that we're using as our test case. So we're going to go back into the IP decapsulation tool. And now we're going to say dot slash configure. and we'll say CC equals AFL-GCC, like we talked about, CXX equals AFLG++, and then we'll close that guy out, let it configure. I'm going to make clean just in case it's not clean right now, and then we'll make. So that all looks good. Now I'm going to make two directories, in and out. So make directory in, out. So those are created. I'm going to copy the 6 and 4 file to my in folder. That's been done because that's where it's going to get its input for the source file for mutations. Then we'll say source ipdcap is going to be the binary minus I. The input folder is in and the file is 6 and 4. Minus output file, use out.pcap. We set that up. And now we'll say afl-fuzz minus I for input. It's in. That's the directory. Minus O is out. We created that as well. Source ipdcap is the binary. That's where it's located. Minus input or minus either. This is where we're going to put at. It's kind of weird, but that's where it's going to populate in the mutation file. And then minus O for output dev null because I don't care to see it. And we run it. And it pops up here in a moment. If it complains at you about the screen size not being large enough, you can just resize your screen. You can see stage progress now trying bit flip 1-1. We already got a crash. That's just how effective it is. So we're going to wait till it gets two unique crashes. A lot of times duplicate crashes will be hit, and we'll see that soon. So total crashes 3, 1 unique. That means it hit the same bug 3 times now. So any moment we should get another unique crash. There's another duplicate. And come on, there we go, we got 2. So I'll hit Control C, we're done here, have a nice day, and now we've got things inside our crashes folder. So ls, out, crashes, and you can see it found 2, the 2 crashes we saw, flip 1 and a flip 4. So pretty neat. So let's go ahead and recompile this thing. So configure, C flags, this time equals minus GGDB for our debugging symbols that we need, and then minus capital O 0 to turn off some optimization. And then when this is done, we'll say make clean, and then make, clear the screen, and we'll go ahead and in GDB open up the binary, and we're simply going to run minus input is out, crashes, and then either one of those is fine. And we'll put minus O for output to dev null, so we don't care. And we hit enter. And we see that seg fault occurred. So I'll hit BT for backtrace to look at the call stack. And we see here that we see the name memcopy again. It's almost like the other bug. I told you memcopy shows up a lot. We see IEEE 802.1Q header. And at source code line number 573, in ipdcap.c. So that was the last function that was called when a crash occurred. So that's probably what we want to go look at. So I'll drop to a shell. Just type shell and we'll say vim source ipdcap.c and we'll hit colon 573. And we jump down to that line number. Line number, and there we got memcopy. So this is expected. And we see, 2 times size of a VLAN tag length. So if you go beyond this and look at the notes in this section in the walkthrough in the bootcamp, it will kind of go through a little bit more detail as to, well, why is that value ending up as the size for memcopy? And then, of course, you can learn how to craft your own packet and see if this is a vulnerability or not. So we'll quit out of there. Go back out to the slide. So at this point, I showed you 2 of the bootcamp labs already, and that was the Sully Fuzzing Framework lab and then the AFL lab. But let's take a look at the bootcamp. It says you've got a couple options, leveraging Scapy and Python. I'll tell you what you need to do there. And then you've got the Sully lab and the AFL lab, which both walkthroughs are available respectively at those sections we already passed over. So let me introduce the Scapy exercise. In your root lab day 3 Wi-Fi mirror.dump, or in your day 3 folder in Kali, Wi-Fi mirror.dump is there. And that is the packet capture that was recorded when running this script. Remember this script from the Scapy section? This is the one where we could sit remotely and sniff on the wireless line and look for dead code MAC addresses and capture that. And that's data being replayed from the wired side wherever it was run. The problem is when you capture that, when you open up that Wi-Fi mirror.dump file, the radio tap and 802.11 headers are on there. So when you open it in Wireshark, this is what it looks like on this screen. I'm going to stop here and tell you what we want you to do. We want you to write a Scapy script that opens up the Wi-Fi mirror.dump file, creates a new file, writing, so it's going to iterate through each packet with a loop, and we want you to pass each packet to a function that you define. That packet should strip off the first two layers to get rid of the radio tap headers and the 802.11 headers, and then write the result out to the new file. And that way it starts at the regular MAC address and IP address that you would expect to see. So that's your goal using your Scapy knowledge. And the lab will walk you through how to do that. But definitely, you know, try this one on your own first. And then the other two, I'm not going to jump to those because I don't want you to see the answer here until you're ready on this one. But we already covered those, and that is the AFL lab and the Sully lab. So work through those, and we are finished with book 3.